welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out, presented by War Scholar. Today I speak with Robert Tynes, who's written a book on the recent use of child soldiers going back about 31 years. He talks about West Africa, terrorist groups, sort of the basis for this going back to Mao, the Chinese Communist Revolution. So we talk about the things he's found, how they're used, how he did his research to get the numbers of child soldiers, how often they're used, some of the implications of using child soldiers and that sort of thing. So really good information on modern war, war against terror. A lot of terror groups are using child soldiers, and not just out of desperation, but as a tool. I'm speaking with Robert Tynes, author of Tools of War, Tools of State, When Children Become Soldiers. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
So tell me how you got into studying this subject and writing about it.
I guess the long story is that I was always interested in kind of Africa and African cultures from an anthropological point of view. So when I was young, I lived in Kenya for a couple months, and that really kind of that's how I became engaged in kind of African culture. And from there, I always kind of maintain a through line of exploring, you know, different facets of African politics. I went to University of Washington for my master's in communication. And at that point, I met an anthropologist who was studied Sierra Leone, a northern culture in Sierra Leone, and he really got me intrigued with Sierra Leone. So that's how, at the time, Sierra Leone was in their civil war, so my shift from African politics to conflict in general was made there. Mm. And I became kind of fascinated with conflict in general, and why do people go to war, and it's such a huge problem. The more I kind of dug into it, mm-hmm. the more I realized it was too complicated to understand on a grand level, so I wanted to focus in on one facet of it, and that was children, because in Sierra Leone, as I write in the book, of course, child soldiers were used by all sides, governments and rebels. So that's really how I got into it. And then when I went on to for my PhD at University of Albany, there are a couple of specialists in political violence there. One of them is Professor Victor Assall, and then David Rousseau, Professor David Rousseau, focuses on international relations. So at that point, I really became even more intrigued by this kind of idea of children in war, and of course they became my dissertation advisors and encouraged me to kind of follow through on just focusing on this part of it. There have been, you know, really a lot of different writings on it, but they tended to be single case studies, or kind of the seminal work that kind of pulled it all together was Peter Singer's Children at War, which is a great kind of comprehensive book of the entire subject.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I just kind of picked up on a lot of his ideas and said, hey, you know what, we really need to analyze this much deeper, because he gives you a good kind of panoramic view, but because of that, he's unable to go to kind of into the deeper analysis, which is really what I decided to do.
So let me start with a few definitions. What do you define as a child, and what do you define as a soldier or active participant in a conflict?
Well, I pretty much would go with, you know, kind of the earlier kind of child soldier definition. So child, you know, it started out to be that the threshold was 15 years old, and later on it gets to change, the threshold rises up to 18, but for the purposes of what I was looking at, I was really looking at 15, because one of the questions I had is this a cultural phenomenon, you know, it had been traditionally framed as an African thing,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't, you know, knowing a lot about Africa, it didn't seem to me like that was really the case. So as I dug deeper into that, I found that I really couldn't find any culture that approved of children being in war. There was a cultural taboo anywhere I looked. And so what I did find is that what was acceptable, what was considered a child, had a lot more to do with kind of adult initiation. Whether it was more of a Western culture, you turn 13 and you, once you pass that threshold, you move into the 15, 16, you start to move into adulthood. A lot of West African cultures that I look at, 13 to 15, it seems to be more of the initiation rite. So that's where I started to see that, you know, after 15, it gets a little blurrier. Now, granted, they changed the threshold to 18 for conscription later on, and that's a great thing. But as far as culturally people, what they deem, it's a little slippery. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it is, the other part you asked was about soldier, what I would define as soldier. For children, that's much more broadly defined. It's not anyone who carries a weapon. It's basically any, you know, child who is engaged actively, either by choice or forced to, in the kind of battle arena. So that anywhere from, you know, a child carrying a gun to spies to porters to, well, in the case of women, it ends up being like sex slaves and cooks. Anything that is, you know, when children are pulled in as part of kind of a war machine, whether it's the rebels or the government, that's when I really see them as being, you know, kind of that identity shift as a soldier.
Just to step back again to the definition of child, is it age-based, or is it based on, as you mentioned, initiation? You know, like you do this particular rite that says you're an adult, you know, is that... How is that approached, if at all?
Yeah, you know, it's not really something that until I really dug into it, that was approached as being a little more slippery that way. You know, the kind of the international treaties, when they really, in order to be effective, have to kind of set a 15 or an 18 age limit, and that's understandable. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, if I choose 15, that's what I use, because I do a statistical regression. That was my cutoff point. But, you know, what I find interesting about this is, as an example, in West African culture, in a lot of the different groups, you need to be initiated into adulthood. And for certain groups, such as the Mende, if you are not initiated into adulthood, you are not allowed to act as a warrior or a fighter in battle. It's considered illegitimate. Mm-hmm. And that's not really age-based. So the normal is around 13 to 15, you go and you become initiated, and then you're considered eligible to fight in war for that group. Mm-hmm. But let's say you're 50 and you're never initiated. You are technically, in that culture, not eligible to be a soldier. So, of course, that's an extreme, but I think, you know, what it tells us is you really have to look at the conflict itself and figure out, you know, are there different cultural usage? Another thing that happened, as far as international treaties, there was some wrangling over this kind of 15 to 18 threshold at different points, because different, you know, rebel factions start to realize that what this did was, if they were fighting against a large government force, the government force had the preponderance of soldiers. So you effectively took out their soldier base, or you delegitimized a good portion of the rebel soldier base. By doing this. And so there was actually some, you know, kind of pushback on this idea that this was more about states, you know, setting a threshold was intended to weaken tactically rebel groups.
Hmm. Interesting. So tell me about the book then.
So the book, as I mentioned before, I kind of started with Peter Singer as the broad idea and kind of pulling hypotheses in different variables out of his book and looking at numerous case studies. And I decided to do what I hadn't seen out there is kind of try, you know, what's called triangulation, looking at it from all different types of analysis. So I did a historical analysis of this, looking at the idea of have children always been used, or is this a shifting norm? I looked at a social network analysis. I took that approach because I wanted to see if how this kind of tactic is, what I say in the end is a tactical innovation. I wanted to see how this tactic is spread. Now, you know, we think in today's world, globally, the media is kind of everywhere, but, you know, 30, 40 years ago, these ideas are mostly spread from group to group, or, you know, when a rebel force studies another war. So one thing that I did is I looked at different kind of meeting places with different rebel groups, places like Libyan training camps, some of these larger terrorist conferences that occurred in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I did historical analysis, and then I did a large end sample. I looked at all the conflicts in the world over a couple of decades, and basically from 1987 to 2007. And I just did kind of the grunt work. I coded for child soldier use, child soldier use by rebels, child soldier use by governments, and I wanted to see what kind of patterns I had there.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of the last two things that I did was I went more of a deep dive into specifics, and that was my single case study of Sierra Leone, which I already knew a lot about, but in exploring that, I also saw a lot of what was going on in Liberia. And then finally, I wanted to see kind of what seemed to be much more contemporary take on this. I looked at groups such as ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab.
Mm-hmm.
And why were they, trying to figure out why were they using children, or what was the point of that?
Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of do a thumbnail sketch, it's by no means comprehensive, but just to add one more piece to this larger puzzle that I was putting together.
So can you talk a bit about, I noticed, that you start with Mao's protracted war.
Sure.
Idea. Can you talk about that a little bit and the child soldier issue in that regard?
Yeah, and this is really, I think, where I start to get at the progression into the tactical innovation. I'm pretty sure this is, the protracted war is mentioned in the Singer book. He doesn't go in depth of it for it, but I looked at it and I really found that, this idea that smaller groups, rebel groups had a huge disadvantage, right, against government forces, and this was Mao's insight. And so it was less about winning the war and more about drawing the war out in any way that they could, because then you start to weaken the government's morale. And the longer you could make the war, more protracted, the greater chance you had. And using child soldiers, now, Mao doesn't do this, but by the time we get kind of a progression from the Korean War and into the Vietnam War, which are, these groups are fully steeped in protracted war theory, I see them really starting to realize children as tools that can be used for protracted war.
Mm-hmm. So I'm surprised, in the Chinese Communist Revolution, they didn't use child soldiers, or is that what you were saying?
Well, they weren't using child soldiers. They certainly were indoctrinating them.
Mm-hmm.
And there may have been, some usage, but it's really more about indoctrinating them into the way of being a soldier for the cause, so that then when they become more of an adult, they will fight. This happens with the Hitler Youth, too. The Hitler Youth really, it's not until the end of World War II that Hitler Youth, the children themselves, become much more engaged in actual battles.
Mm-hmm.
Or any sort of fighting. And so, you know, you see hints of it, but it's not an all-out, considered an all-out tool. It's more kind of, oh, we need more manpower here, so we're going to start to engage younger and younger people. But the protracted war, you move away from just children, you know, in Vietnam. It's not children as just more manpower, but there's a psychological component that starts to be really capitalized on in Vietnam. You know, this idea of the child is innocent, they wouldn't have a bomb, that wouldn't be possible. And that gives you a huge advantage if you start using children. You know, if you can weaken the other side and let a child move into what the opposition force saw as a defensive line, you get much deeper into it. It's not just a historical thing. I did interview some soldiers who had been in Afghanistan, and one of the questions I asked is, a while back was, you know, did you ever see children on the battlefield? And they said, oh, no, not soldiers. And I said, yeah, but were children around? And they said, yeah, all the time. And I said, well, I asked, well, what would you do if you were face to face with a child, you know, on the battlefield? And they said, well, I would follow the rules of engagement and I would fire on them completely. And I said, so you would have no kind of moral, you know, resistance to this? And they said, no, it'd be rules of engagement. And I said, well, what about the children who were around you at the time in these villages and stuff? And I said, did you, you know, ever get worried? And they said, yeah, but, you know, it wasn't a big deal. And I said, well, tell me about it. And he said, well, you know, we used to give them candy and they'd come up. And I remember one time one of them came up and was climbing on me and started grabbing my gun and playing around. And I said, well, then what did you do? Did you just let them do that? And he said, well, actually, no, I threw him to the ground because then I started to realize that he was a threat. Mm-hmm. So the mere fact that you would never let an adult do that. Was a real key, you know, highlighted this idea of the vulnerability of children. Mm-hmm. I also found that very dangerous because, you know, the story of this soldier telling me about he would just follow rules of engagement, that may have actually been effective on the battlefield, but when someone comes home after a long time, the part of the kind of processing of what went on, you know, there has been some work with soldiers who have actually had to kill children, and they end up really, it's psychologically just completely damaging afterwards and demoralizing. So, it becomes really complicated. And I think when I saw more of that, that's not your normal battlefield engagement. There's much more going on.
Is it, all the case studies that you looked at, was it easier for a group to use child soldiers where the children maybe didn't have parents? Or, because I would imagine parents would be resistant to having their children drawn in.
Yeah, it really varies, you know. Family structure is extremely important. There's a full spectrum of why children, you know, they can either go to war or they're forced to do it. If they're forced to do it, like you said, if they have a strong family structure, they might be more resistant to do it. So that's why, actually, when you get things like the Lord's Resistance Army, you get Tony and his group getting children. One thing that they do to kind of deprogram and reprogram children is have them brutalize family members. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe cut off, you know, an uncle's hand. And this happens in Sierra Leone, too. And it's getting at exactly at what you're saying, that there's a recognition that the family structure, it could be really strong and could keep the child actually from joining the rebel forces or being effective as a rebel soldier. And so kind of breaking that societal bond becomes one thing that rebel groups, I see, is very important.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a bit about what you found with ISIS and Al-Shabaab.
Well, the ISIS, the Al-Shabaab, and the Boko Haram, that's, you know, kind of the second part of this is really a conscious, especially with ISIS and Al-Shabaab, different with Boko Haram, Boko Haram tends to be much more of a traditional rebel force pretending that they're building a state, whereas ISIS and Al-Shabaab have, you know, very strong institutional structures where they're pulling children in, they're creating schools. Not only are they creating schools, they're creating schools that are indoctrinating the children not only in the culture that they want their state to be, the caliphate, but also the idea that you should kill and die for that state. And they're doing this with children at a very young age. And, you know, you see this when all these materials are coming out about once, you know, in Syria when ISIS is pulled back and people go into the towns and they go through all the documentation. It's very clear that ISIS and Al-Shabaab know what it means to kind of capture the minds of children and use the minds of children to help build the state. That it's a much more strong state if you have them kind of a national identity that you're creating through the children, as opposed to just operating at the adult level.
Mm-hmm. So at first it sounded like using children, some of the examples you gave, it sounded like it was a desperation measure, whereas now it sounds like it's no longer desperation, but as you say, you know, it's a tactical use of them, whether or not you have enough regular forces.
Yeah, I think it's purely tactical. You know, that's very much of this century. At least, you know, what I found from the 80s on, that it's tactical. It's not desperation. It's a knowledge that it's not just, you know, manpower. You get psychological power. It definitely, because of that psychological component, I think it becomes a force amplifier like none other. You know, I mean, kind of the cliche is winning the hearts and minds. Well, I think at this point for groups such as ISIS and Al-Shabaab, it's understanding that hearts and minds of children build a caliphate that will last, you know, for decades as opposed to over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if ISIS dissolves, the indoctrination of the children is still there. They still carry that with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So of the many cases, did you find were children trained in as groups of children, or were they, you know, individually split up and paired up with adults to learn, you know?
Some of both. I think I found it really depends on the nature of the conflict, whether there's time, you know, to kind of break off and just train children. Certainly with ISIS and Al-Shabaab, you know, if you have schools, you can train schools. I mean, you can train groups of children. You know, if you get into kind of the caliphate, these kind of ideas. But in something like the Lord's Resistance Army or the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front in Sierra Leone, this is a much more, you know, we're going to train you, we're going to deprogram you, and we're going to put you out on the battlefield right away. I think there's, you know, kind of an urgency that goes on and that makes it different than these other types of. So I guess the short of it is, yes, all of it. You get groups of children being trained, and then you get one, you know, a child being trained with an adult.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that one of the dangers, if you're not worried about the moral implications, one of the dangers of using children is just their maturity level and their, you know, their ability, their physical ability to be involved with combat. And as they get older, you know, if they start out as soldiers, as they get older, would they question more, or, you know, do you discuss anything like that?
I don't go into that. I mean, that's a great question and definitely something that could be explored more.
Mm-hmm.
I think the assumption is that the concern is that as they get older, you've actually, if you've kind of broken down all their social structures and rebuild them around being a soldier, that that's what they're going to hang on to. And so as they become an adult, it becomes more and more embedded in who they are.
Mm-hmm. So their life is the soldier life. They don't go back to...
That's what they know. You know, unless, and this is why it's important kind of post-conflict, is what do you do for these children who, some of whom are now adults, all they know is soldiering, what do? You know, and, you know, this is where it's important to have education and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a job, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to want to join the police force or find another conflict or, you know, kind of a military position.
So, before we turn to how you actually did your research, do you have any other issues or themes that you want to mention that you discuss in the book?
I guess kind of one thing that I found fascinating and would, I think, you know, warrants great more, much more exploration is this idea of the resistance in some of these children. So, you know, I'm just starting to wonder about, we kind of think of it as children are forced in or they either jump out, and it's kind of a, you know, kind of a flat plane. But one thing that I found is I interviewed a couple of child soldiers in Sierra Leone, and one of them I said, you know, how did you get in? And he said, well, I was forced, you know. And I had no choice. And another now man, by the time he said it was a boy, and I said, why did you? You know, what happened? He said, oh, I volunteered. And I said, really? Why did you volunteer? And he said, well, I volunteered for the RUF because my brother and other family members had been forced in. So what I figured was I would join, I would climb up the ranks, and then I would help my family members and other child soldiers escape. Huh. And that's exactly what he did. So he, you know, became a good soldier, and he was allowed to, at a certain point, lead groups of other children out on the battlefield. And so what he would do is he would lead them out onto the battlefield, and then he would lead them away from the battlefield, and he would tell one or two of the boys to run away. It was mostly boys that he was with. And he would find them out. And so then when he would come back, they would say, well, you lost three people? And he was like, yeah, I lost them on the battlefield. They were killed. And he did this, for a couple years. And I thought that was amazing that not only was, you know, strategically really smart, but this was a boy who thought this up. No one taught him to do this. He was very smart and said, how am I going to solve this problem? And I think there's a lot more of that that goes on in various conflicts with children and how they manage the battlefield, both men and women, or boys and girls at the time.
Okay, so you mentioned a little bit about how you collected your data. Can you go into more detail about how you got your numbers, where you found them, that sort of thing?
I looked at various, for the child soldiers, the way I did it is I just went through all open source documents that I could find about every conflict that I was covering over this, 20-year period. And so whether it was Human Rights Watch reports or Amnesty International or, I would just do kind of searches through newspapers from various countries when I knew there was a battle going on and looking for any mention of children in age. And so I had to see, I couldn't just say child, it actually had to say a specific age that they confirmed so that I knew that, child could be 19 to someone, they don't necessarily know. So I basically just scoured every possible document I could find on every conflict that I was looking at to see if there was evidence of children. So one of the things that I found was that, I know I'm underreporting children being used in various conflicts because you know, I would find evidence of it, but I don't know in the conflicts. Just because someone, it's not reported, it doesn't mean it didn't happen, right?
So, how about the interviews that you did? How many did you do? Where'd you have to go?
Oh, well, you know, I did interviews with American soldiers here. And then for the case study, which is where most of the interviews of the children are, I went to Sierra Leone and I did field work in Sierra Leone. In the course of being there, then I also met with various government officials, other people who were in the military at the time, members of the rebel groups. I just basically, you know, kind of worked my way through different networks and just kept talking to people, you know. People were very, you know, willing to talk, actually.
So it's interesting that you both sides allowed you to go in and talk to them. They felt comfortable enough with you. How did you establish that comfort level?
Well, I think, you know, it's, I don't think anybody's, I mean, you know, once they established that I was a researcher and not a government official, I think that was a big help, because they knew that I didn't have an agenda other than to just understand what had happened. I think some people were, you know, upset, and it actually helped them to talk about it. It made it more real, as opposed to something that they're constantly haunted by. And, I was a reporter for a while. I just find that, you know, people actually like to tell their stories. And I think that's a good thing in the end, because the more we know about what people think and why they think that way, the more likely we are to kind of cooperate with one another as opposed to not understand. So that's kind of a larger, you know, philosophical take on it, but that seems to be, for me, why I think people like to talk.
Do you think saying you're a researcher was better than saying a journalist, say? Is there more negative connotation with being a journalist and better with being a researcher?
Certainly in West Africa, to say I'm a researcher and have a PhD is highly respected, just for the educational part of it. West African culture really respects, you know, university and anybody who's from university, and they tend to understand what it means to actually do research. But, you know, even as a journalist, I don't think, because of the time, I mean, it certainly might be different now with the world that we live in, but at the time, even as a journalist, there wouldn't be resistance, I don't think.
So, I know this wouldn't have really been part of your research, but did anyone show you any places or objects or anything associated with child soldiers at all?
Well, in my course of, you know, going around Sierra Leone, certainly, and knowing the history of it, I knew of places, you know, and certain events that had happened around the country. And as I talked to various people, they would certainly say, if I was in their village, they would say, well, you know, the rebels came in here and they saw this and they did this over here. So I would see the places, but it was never, you know, it was more like I was seeing kind of memories. You know, these were ways for people to kind of engage their memories of what had happened.
What part of the research was most enjoyable?
I really like interviews. I like talking with people. That's the most enjoyable. To hear people's stories, it to me is the most enjoyable, because I'm always fascinated how rich everybody's life is, and you know, especially when I was in Sierra Leone, this was a place that was, you know, it was a decade long civil war, and just really hearing how people, like, not so much survive, but just kind of exist in that world at that time. It it always fascinates me how kind of resilient and hopeful people are. They're not, you know, in those times of kind of greatest horror, it seems that a lot of times people are their most hopeful. Mm-hmm. And I always find that amazing.
Did you tape all the interviews?
I did not. I did not tape them. I acted more like a reporter, and I transcribed and took notes throughout. For one reason, when I was in Sierra Leone, you know, taping them would necessitate either electricity or batteries, and technology always fails. I'm much more like dependent upon writing down things. Pencil and paper always works really well.
I also think that people are maybe a little more open, or less open if it's being taped, you know, if a permanent record is being made.
Yeah, I think, you know, there tends to be, much, you know, it's much less self-conscious if you aren't taping, if you're writing things down. And it's funny, at a certain point, I was interviewing people, and I wasn't taking notes. I would interview them, and then after I stopped the interview and then went and sat down or whatever, or went back to my room, I would write down all my notes. Mm-hmm. And I did that because I was usually so engaged in the conversation, I didn't want to disrupt the flow and take any chance of someone being self-conscious about it. Mm-hmm. But at one point, you know, and that was fine most of the time, but at one point, someone said to me, "How come you're not taking notes? Do you not think what I'm saying is important?" And I said, "No, that's not at all. I was trying to be respectful." And so I said, "I'm more than happy to take notes in front of you." And he said, "Good, because I want you to." So I thought that was interesting, you know, kind of the opposite of my perception.
Did you ever interview groups of people?
No, I did not. I didn't interview groups of people because of the subject itself was much more of a private one-on-one conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly had discussed some of the ideas around groups of people, and they've had their input, but and I did get, you know, some interesting ideas out of that, but it was much more intimate and personal type of process, and so I always kind of maintained that.
Was there anything, you said there was something that you found that was very fascinating, but was there something you discovered that was very surprising to you that you didn't expect?
Kind of fascinating, surprising. I would have to say that the kind of those systems of resistance of children was the most surprising. I think the other part, which I mentioned, that the most surprising is how resilient people are. I mean, I met all sorts of different kids who had gone through horrible, horrible things, and some of them were completely damaged, but others, and I really like to try and figure out what it was, others had, you know, gone through it, witnessed the horrors, and kind of went on, like, life as normal, and that this was a horrible thing, but they had moved on. So I don't know why some people it's more damaging to others. So that was a little, like, the range of kind of post-conflict identities or experiences, that was pretty surprising to me. I thought it was going to be a little more monolithic.
Was there so I know collecting the data was difficult, but was there a particular issue that was very difficult to nail down, so to speak, or something that you really wish you could have figured out?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, I did this network analysis, and one of the things that, the network really connects through these Libya training camps. And I did find, you know, evidence of children being in the training camp. And I did find documents saying different types of training events that soldiers went through, but I did not find any straight out documentation of, now we're going to use children and we're going to have them crawl under barbed wire, now we're going to have them carry bombs, and that's kind of one piece that I would really like to see, is if there were specific manuals that were geared towards children. You definitely see that with ISIS later on, but kind of the Libyan training camps under Gaddafi, that's what I would like to find. And that's been very hard, partly because of the nature of the training camps and the secrecy and kind of the ongoing kind of back and forth between the U.S. and Libya. I've contacted certainly the CIA, Freedom of Information Act, and looked through different, congressional testimony, but it's a pretty cloaked world.
Mm-hmm. Was there
any leads? That would be great.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I said, so if anybody has any leads on that, that would be great, because I'm still looking for those kind of manuals geared toward children.
Mm-hmm. Was there, you mentioned some things that sort of moved you emotionally. Was there anything else that particularly moved you either positively or negatively about your research or in your research?
Oh, well, I mean, the negative is just how brutal people can be in not understanding. I mean, the RUF was just so brutal. Different, and I don't mean that in a kind of like the RUF as a rebel force. I mean, there were some individuals in the RUF who were just awful, did awful, awful things. And I do not understand that. I don't understand how people can be moved to, actively go out and destroy other people, cutting off hands and arms and using that as a political tool. That's kind of beyond my comprehension. But again, the upside is it's amazing some of the people who went through that, are living life and have hope. So I don't, that's kind of the other end of it. It's like, wow, you face the greatest horror of all, and you still think life is wonderful. So,
Yeah, that's, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
What do you hope the book will do?
My hope is that the book will kind of carry on shining this light on that, the use of children in war is not okay. And it's something that will, it's a social norm that should be a global social norm, and it should stay that way. And that, it's because it's tactical, it's actually something that can be, resisted. That there are ways, if it's a tactic, we can come up with a counter tactic. And it's a counter tactic that actually protects children, doesn't put them deeper into the fray. What I have noticed, it's kind of, to me, the sad part is that, like I said, in the opening of the book, that this isn't just an African thing, that it's kind of a battle that's going on in global social norms. So if we, kind of extend that and off of the battlefield and just look at this idea of, children and guns in the U.S., this is the same idea. The idea that whether it's acceptable or not for children to have guns, and I think when you start lowering the threshold, you're eroding something that you're not making kind of conflict and war an extreme thing anymore. And I think kind of conflict should always be thought of as an extreme, not as closer to the norm. So if we can kind of, one particular way of fending that off is, don't let children become soldiers. Mm-hmm. It's not okay, And when we start doing that, then, it kind of opens up the floodgate for all other norms to erode.
Mm-hmm. So can you speak to
that? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book finished or published and how you overcame those issues?
I think that there weren't really, the only difficulty was being patient and knowing that this was going to take years to figure out, that this wasn't like a do research and get it done in a year, that just keep writing and researching and writing and researching and just being patient. I think patience is something that I really learned in doing this book.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, how worthwhile is it studying this same subject and going back into, say, the 19th century, 18th century? You know, do you think finding trends in this that far back is important?
Yeah, I do. I think it gets much more to the kind of the sociological component, that, you know, you're saying, if you can see it as a historical through line and a progression, then it's less of, oh, we just have to pull children off the battlefield, and, oh, this is a longer-term historical trend, so it's going to take a longer, you know, historical reversal of this trend. We can't, you know, just expect to, you know, whether it's in the U.S. pass legislation and say, for instance, we won't give military aid as the United States government to anybody who uses child soldiers in Yemen, right? Mm-hmm. That's a quick fix, I think, and it's good, but it's not really taking into account that this was a long term, you know, centuries old historical progression, and so it's going to take a while to kind of flip this back if that's really what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. And I certainly understand the difficulty of going that far back and trying to study this, but, you know, it just makes me wonder, you know, you go back centuries, people were adults when they were 13, you know,
right.
What did that mean? You know, if they were starting to be soldiers then, what did that mean for society as a whole?
Yep.
Was there more war because of it? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, certainly, this idea of, you know, the place of children in society is something that kind of flip-flops back and forth. You know, we tend to want children to be rugged and hardy in the U.S. and go out and get jobs and, you know, be self-sufficient, but at the same time, we want them to stay in school and be protected. And this kind of dialectic that goes back and forth has been going on for centuries. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe there is no, like, oh, children will never be, you know, pulled into battle. But maybe we're seeking more of at least a return to a balance of it. You know, I don't know, because I think it's going to take decades more to work this kind of thing out.
Yeah, and just a little maybe trivial aside, you know, since I do the sci-fi stuff too, I just thought of Ender's Game, you know, where they use children to, you know, they turn them into children to wage, you know, war
yep.
against aliens. It's kind of,
yep.
you know, I guess.
I think, you know, it's important to look at things such as science fiction and other, you know, kind of fictional portrayals of children, because I think what you are seeing is not only if it's, you know, science fiction, people, they're imagining the future, but it's really based on a lot of stuff that's going up now and seeing where potential can go.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think looking at things, science fiction is a great place to also understand the problem.
Mm-hmm. Because as warfare becomes more technological and literally almost like a video game in a sense, you
sure.
know, and you have kids now master video games and technology, you know, when they're 5 years old, they're using it, you know, and then can someone
yep.
say, well, they can do it, so we'll have them wage war for us, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. It is a danger. you know, and not only do they master video games, they seem to know it much more, you know, it's much more hardwired into them already,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to someone like me who's much older. It's, I can learn these things, but I don't pick them up and just do it, which children seem to be able to do today with video games, at least in this culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
What's your next writing project?
My next writing project. Well, you know, I'm always looking at the following kind of the child soldier phenomenon, but I also look at kind of political conflicts and groups such as ISIS online using social media. I also look at other political activism, right, such as Anonymous, and how they, one thing that I wrote recently was about an anonymous group called GoSec that would go in and attack social media sites that were being used by ISIS members.
Mm.
So I'm interested in that as well, how this, these kinds of things play out on the internet.
So people will be able to, so tell me where people can find the book, and then do you have social media or anything where people can follow, keep up with your thoughts and work?
Yeah, I don't really have a social media account. I don't, you know, I don't blog or anything. Mm. The book itself is on SUNY Press.
Mm.
It's also on Amazon. So if you look there, either there, you know, you just search for Tools of War, Tools of State, it'll be there.
Mm.
Most of my writing is done for journals. The GoSec stuff that I've written is some online stuff with LIM Magazine, LIMN. Magazine. So, I mean, it's much more like just Google my name and a search term that you're interested in, like child soldiers, and my stuff will come up.
Mm-hmm. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I don't. Thank you for asking me so many questions. It, you know, I don't. Oddly enough, you know, you bury your head in a book for a long time, and you don't necessarily get to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Always nice to talk about it.
No, it's cool stuff. I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name Chris does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.